Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here this morning. My name is Sarah Martin. I'm a journalist at Guardian Australia, and I'm here with Polly Toynbee to talk about her book, An Uneasy Inheritance. Before we get started, we acknowledge this land that we meet on today is the traditional lands for the Kaurna people and that we respect their spiritual relationship with their country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. Polly Toynbee is a Guardian columnist. She previously was the BBC social affairs editor. She's a Tory fighter. She's also one of the few people to have seen Boris Johnson naked, and we will get to that story.
Not few, many.
Well, in fact, probably many more than we suspect. But look, you know, she's in a club at least. There's so much to talk about. Her book is absolutely brilliant. And I thought we'd just start, Polly, by asking you to take us back to the genesis of this book, which is sort of part memoir, part social commentary. What led you to write a memoir, but through the prism of class, which is quite an unusual thing to do?
Well, I've never written about myself before. I'm a journalist, I'm a commentator, I write about politics, I wrote about social policy, many books together with my partner, David Walker. He's sitting there in the front writing even as we speak. The idea of writing something about myself or my family just hadn't crossed my mind until I was asked by Radio 4 to make a programme called The Class Ceiling, which was about class in Britain. And in the course of that, the producer and I went round and we started asking everybody we were interviewing, whether they were professors or for whatever reason, about themselves and their attitude to class. Where did they come from? Where did they place themselves on the class spectrum? And I got more and more interested in this. And we started stopping people in the street and asking them, and found it was a really penetrating way into getting the whole of somebody's life story. Everybody has a story to tell about class. If you say to someone, tell me a time in your life when you either felt too posh or not posh enough, outpourings of embarrassment amongst the posh and of a certain amount of resentment amongst the not posh enough. There are gradations and gradations within gradations, subtleties about cousins who moved up or cousins who moved down, what happens within families. Everybody has a story to tell. And it's a very good way, it's a very good tin opener for family stories. So as we went along doing this, after a while, the producer said to me, but listen, we can't go on doing this without you saying something about your class. I said, oh, no, absolutely not. It's not about me. I'm just here as the reporter, as the commentator. No, I think you should say something. And I thought about it all. Anybody listening to Radio 4 will kind of guess from my voice, the way you do in Great Britain, what kind of class I might come from. Also, the fact that I was a professional. But I didn't, you know, I had avoided this all my life, having to actually describe it. Embarrassed that I'd been at private school for some of my education, embarrassed at the privilege of my background, and as you do, you kind of shy away from it and try and cover it up. So it was not something we were discussing this about, how The Guardian has always been embarrassed at having quite a lot of private school educated journalists. And gets it, you know, I think, much more socially aware in terms of recruiting young people now than certainly they were when I was recruited. But I didn't want to do it, but he made me. So I, in the shortest way possible, I said, I come from generations of people who've been professionals. They've been intellectuals, writers, teachers. A lot of them have been professors. And they've been comfortably off, middle class, upper middle class, doing very well for themselves, but all of them on the radical left and feeling embarrassed about it and not quite knowing how to put those two things together. So that was about as much as I said. But I went away and thought about it after I'd made the programme and thought, I need to look into this more. Lots of people write fantastic memoirs about how they've come up from nowhere, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps and to make it. And always fascinating stories. But wonderful, I don't know if he's been here ever, wonderful memoir by Lem Cisse, the poet, about coming from a really hard childhood in care and utter neglect to being this wonderful poet. Those books are great, and we're used to that. But I thought, well, nobody's actually written about being middle class, the awkwardnesses of being middle class, and the fact that you could never say, I got there on my merit. So I, obviously, when I looked into my background, I spent an awful lot of time looking for any kind of working class roots I could find. A root, a twig, a branch, give me some credibility somewhere. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. There was my... I have Australian origins. My great-grandfather, Gilbert Murray, who was Regius Professor of Greek, came from Australia. And his mother was a governess. And I thought, oh, well, maybe a governess. Maybe she's got a working class. Not a bit. She came from educated, middle-class people who'd fallen down in the world, so she'd become a governess. So seeking justification for your position is a quite an important part. Just before the book came out, a piece of research came out from the London School of Economics, and they interviewed a whole lot of people who were higher managerial or professional and asked them about what was their class, and nearly 50% of them said, oh, I'm working class. What? How could you be working class? And some of them would say, well, my parents didn't go to university, I come from... Fine. Some of them said, oh, my grandparents. Some of them even said, my great-grandfather was a miner. I mean, anything they could find that justified their position in the world, that they must have got it on merit. I don't know, in any sense, to what extent I owe everything I have to my background. Mm.
So take us back to that moment where you were asked that question, you had that sort of internalised embarrassment. Why were you embarrassed? What was the sort of dirty little secret you felt you were hiding?
Well, I think all middle-class people on the left, and an awful lot of these days middle-class people are on the left, are aware of the ambiguities and embarrassments. And partly because you get attacked all the time by the Tories and by people on the right saying, well, if you're so left-wing, then why haven't you given everything away? What are you doing having a nice house and a decent salary? And even if you give some of your money away, never going to be enough. You're never going to be Mahatma Gandhi. And so I thought of analysing that would be useful, partly because there's not much point in going about feeling guilty. What matters is what you do and what you do with your life and whatever position you're in. And if you're the sort of person who stands up for the underdog, using all the power and influence and position that you have or education you have to stand up for the underdog as an instinctive way of being. And it's not very constructive, really, to go about beating your chest all the time or pretending that you're not as middle class as you are.
I mean, it's sort of insanity, though, the counter-argument that once you reach a certain level of comfort, you should hang on to it and become someone who doesn't do any social good whatsoever.
Absolutely. You know, so I see. So if you've got money, you should be voting Conservative or Liberal here because you're a class traitor otherwise to the class of people who are the owners of things. And that's ridiculous. And David and I wrote a book called Unjust Rewards. This is the most difficult part of the book that we wrote together, in which we dragooned very, very high-paid people, high-paid city lawyers and high-paid city bankers, Goldman Sachs-type people. They were earning up to 10 million a year. It took us a long time to get them together in two different focus groups with a professor from the LSE who would explain to them what the actual facts were. We gave them a questionnaire to fill out to say... where do you think your earnings are on the scale? What do you think other people earn? These are the people in charge of all our money. They were clueless. They had no idea at all. They thought the benefit level was at twice the level that it really was. At that point, when only 10% of people were in the top highest paying level of tax, they wouldn't believe it. They said it must be 50%. Everybody we know, we said, yeah, everybody you know. But 90% of the people in the country are on the lower basic rate of tax. And they find these things very, very hard to absorb and really believe, because they saw the world in which there were skivers and scroungers and useless people who, you know, they kept telling us stories about single mothers who just get pregnant so they can get a council house, full of this Daily Mail kind of view of the world. Mm. And no knowledge, actual knowledge, statistical knowledge about the shape of things. And when asked where to put themselves on the graph, put themselves much nearer the middle. You know, they're not 1%. They're 0.01% at the very top. And they found that very hard to believe, because you always compare yourself to the people you know. So those of them who had yachts compared themselves to those who have yachts with crews.
I don't even know what a yachts with cruises, but okay. So you take this decision to delve into your family background. You find earls and countesses and professors and this incredible sort of lineage of intelligentsia in the UK. Did you know that was your background, or were you secretly hoping to find a log cabin story? I mean, did you know already instinctively that's where you had come from?
Well, they were all writers, and what's more, people wrote about them too, so I knew pretty much about all of them except one, which you might come to a bit later. I knew about my great-great-grandmother, who was the Countess of Carlisle, who owned Castle Howard. Again, a ferocious...
If you've seen Bridgerton, that's one of the very, very fancy house in Bridgerton.
Very, very... It's the most beautiful Vanbrugh castle in Yorkshire. Where Brideshead Revisited was first filmed. But she was very much on the left. She was a passionate Irish home ruler, which split the left at the time. She was rabidly temperate, so she went round not only shutting all the pubs on her estate, but she spent... the first thing she did when she took over the castle was to smash all the bottles of wine in the cellar. And she was a strong vegetarian as well. She was full of radicals. She was also kind of monster. She had 11 children and ended up really not speaking to any of them. Her sons were mostly alcoholics. In fact, all the way through the family, it tended to go temperance, alcoholic, all the way through. And her daughter was my great-grandmother, who married Gilbert Murray, who was the Australian and the Regius Professor of Greek. And they lived a very, very abstemious life. Again, vegetarian, temperance. Great friends of George Bernard Shaw, who was both of those things as well. And they also had trouble with their children, who mostly took to drink.
I sort of want to ask where you are. Are we in a temperance or an alcohol? What say to the family tree?
I look at me and my siblings, and I think we've sort of escaped both. I don't think any of us are either. We drink quite a lot, but I don't think any of us are either alcoholics. Certainly not temperance.
Well, you broke the cycle. Well done. So I wanted to delve into some of the characters in the book, because there are some fascinating characters, and they could be in fiction. They are quite spectacular. Tell us about the villain of the book, your relative Rosalind.
My grandmother, who I never met. She poked me when I was a baby and decided she didn't like the look. She'd taken against my father and his older brother and sort of cast them off. She was the daughter of Gilbert Murray and became the sort of only one who was a rebel in the family. She turned to Catholicism, for instance, which, you know, was absolutely... He was a humanist, he was president of the humanists, an atheist, all the rest of them were atheists. And they always felt that she'd done this to sort of get her own back. She also spent a lot of time with a kind of hunting shooting set, which appalled them. The idea of killing animals was absolute anathema to them. She did everything she could to annoy them. But she was also a monstrous mother. She was married to Arnold Toynbee, the historian, who wrote 12 volumes of The Study of History that in its time was rather like sort of Fukuyama, was a great popular historian. He was on the front page of Time magazine, on the front cover of Time magazine, the year that I was born. And she treated him terribly, and he absolutely adored and worshipped her. She was very snobbish. She always thought, I've come from the aristocracy and I've married beneath me. But really, it was the real hypocrisy was this thing about Catholicism. When she became a Catholic, she managed to get an annulment from the Pope, from Arnold Toynbee, and they had three children. So what the Pope wouldn't give to Henry VIII, he would give to my grandmother, Rosalind. She got her annulment. And then she went off to live with a Trappist monk. And she always described to the family how this was the most pure meditative relationship, and they spent their time in prayer and silent contemplation. And she totally despised anybody in the family who did anything wrong. I had a cousin who had a child out of wedlock, and she never spoke to her again. I mean, it took tremendously high moral standards. After she died, she left behind these diaries about the wild sex life she had with this Trappist monk. And by that time, my father and his brother, who were utterly shocked because they'd been so harshly treated by her for their own immoralities. So she was the great hypocrite and the great monster. I mean, I think every book needs a villain, and it's her. All the rest of them are rather virtuous, comical in their attempts at virtue.
Well, yeah, let's go to some of that, because there was obviously this awareness of class and privilege ran very deep in your family, and there were sort of attempts to, I guess, counteract that with deeds. There was a commune. Can you tell us about the commune?
That's my father, who all his life was looking for ways to be good and ways to be better. He was one of the founders of CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and was passionate about that. He was a bit of a millenarian. He always thought the world was going to come to an end in one form or another. And when we were kids growing up, learning about the nuclear bomb and what was going to happen to us, we know we'd all read Neville Shoot on the beach. We all knew about strontium 90 and what it was going to do with us, So when we went on holiday to Wales one year, we had to turn around and come back again halfway there because he'd forgotten the big jar of suicide pills for us all for when the bomb dropped.
I assume you were very well behaved on these holidays.
We used to eye the jar with a certain amount of anxiety, it's true. So I went back, got the jar, and off we went to Abzok.
And they were genuinely suicide pills.
I don't know what he got his hands on. It was probably a huge amount of aspirins, more than we could possibly have swallowed. But he just felt it was very important to know that we would not have to suffer the horrors of post-nuclear Holocaust.
Yeah, and they did take themselves very seriously, didn't they, your forebears?
Oh, they did. Well, yes and no. Mm. My father was quite good at being self-mocking about his own failings. I mean, in the end of his life, you were talking, he decided the answer to this conundrum about what to do. He was a book reviewer for the Observer newspaper and a journalist. And the conundrum for him, again, was how to live the good life and yet live a privileged life. He had not a lot of money, but he had a quite nice house of the country, and decided the answer was to set up a commune, an agricultural commune, because he thought the world now was coming to an end through starvation, and unless we all learnt to dig and grow our own vegetables, we wouldn't survive. And used to say to me, because by then I was, thank God, grown up and living in London, you Londoners, you'll come creeping to our door begging for a cabbage. So he set up this commune with the best of intentions, that he would give everything away to everybody in the commune after 5 years. And it would also have a certain kind of spiritual dimension, a kind of seeking for truths. And in fact, it got swamped with a whole lot. He put advertisements in the alternative press saying, come and join our agricultural commune. A whole lot of people turned up who were really not interested in digging. He was a great one for digging, but they weren't. So they would go off and sit in the woods and chant Om and do some primal screaming and things of that kind. And would say, no, I'm afraid we're too busy with our spiritual work today, Philip, to do any digging.
And so they all went very hungry, I imagine.
It all fell apart in complete chaos at the end and left him very despairing, I think, feeling this had been his great attempt to give things away and make things work. And it didn't work, as communes often don't. Mm. And my poor youngest half-sister was still living at home there, and my poor stepmother, and they had a pretty hard time of it.
How long did it last for?
Lasted about 4 years. Okay. Something like that.
And a few failed crops by the sound of it. Okay, there's so much in this book, and I'm acutely aware of our time limitations. Just this incredible cast of characters, and you have to buy and read the book to learn all about them, because we really have just touched the surface. But I wanted to talk, Polly, about the sort of other element of your book, which is your workbooks and how you sort of came to be in the position where this curiosity about class led you to sort of experiments, really. One in your 20s where you tell us the story. They're not here to listen to me. You tell the story.
Well, after I left university, which I didn't stay till the end because I hated it, I was at Oxford and I threw it away, which was kind of madness, I went and worked in a number of factories and up and down the country. When I then got a job at The Observer, I'd written a novel, and that got me a job at The Observer, which was a great place to work. And there I was on the news desk, and I suddenly realised that I knew really nothing about the country I was reporting on. What did I know? Middle-class girl, been to Oxford, lived in London mostly. And so I took time off, and I went and took jobs around the country. I went to Birmingham and worked in a car parts factory. I worked for Unilever in Port Sunlight, making Vim. I don't think you have Vim anymore. In a Cake Lion's cake factory in a hospital. And I joined the Women's Army for a bit and wrote a book about that, a sort of exploratory book, talking about, not about poverty, but about people on the absolute basic manual wage and what it was like. And, of course, how people are so much more intelligent than the jobs they do, with mostly working on production lines. And then I went back over 30 years later, by which time I was much older and wiser, by which time I'd been the BBC social affairs correspondent, editor. I had written a lot about social conditions, and I'd done a lot of films about it for Panorama and other things. I knew a good deal more about, and I'd read a huge amount of social reports, and I knew where I was looking for. Labour were now in power, and I wanted to see whether the minimum wage had made a real difference. I did it much more scientifically this way. I took a flat on a council estate about 10 minutes away from where I live in South London, but I lived in the posh bit of Clapham, and this was one of the poorest council estates, and took whatever jobs I could get at the minimum wage from the local job centre. And I worked in a nursery, in a care home, in a call centre, in a cake packing factory, and back in the same hospital. Same grade of job. Last time I'd been caught was called a healthcare assistant. It was called a ward orderly. This time I was there as a porter. And I wanted to know what had happened. 33 years. What had happened to pay in that time? Now, I'd been writing a lot about pay in those years, about what had happened in the Thatcher years, about how the Thatcher years had blown apart a story of growing equality, and it had suddenly taken off into wildly growing inequality during the 1980s in her time. So I took my payslip from the two places in the working in that hospital to the Institute for Fiscal Studies and said, what's really happened to my pay in that time? And they looked at them and said, you've lost roughly a third of your pay in real terms. And that made it very real, because although I'd written a lot about what had happened to pay, to actually have a concrete example, and this was because during those years, Thatcher had insisted that all manual jobs working for state organisations like hospitals or schools or whatever were all outsourced to companies who would then pay people much less. And that was the mechanism by which, working in the same hospital, I could be paid so much less. And I think sometimes doing things yourself, you find out things that you wouldn't necessarily think to ask or wouldn't ask the right questions. What you don't find out, what you don't play with for one minute, is the idea of, oh, I know what it would like to be low paid, because I have no idea what it would really be like. I was doing this as a reporting exercise, keeping account of every penny that I spent, of every penny that I earned, what I could afford to have and not have, like you know, not afford to go on a tube train, never afford a glass of wine, never afford to go to a movie or even to go swimming, but you can just about keep yourself going, pay the electricity and the rent on the minimum wage just. But it was not an experience of mine. Every minute of my life has been totally secure. I've always known people I can fall back on, things I could fall back on if ever I was any trouble. Not one minute of my life have I ever been insecure. And I cannot imagine what it's like. The fact that a third of people in Britain have only £100 in savings. They are that much away from penury if they lose their job. Half of people have, you know, virtually none. And that is an experience I could never share, whatever I did. So that I was doing this very much as a reporting exercise, not as, now I know what it's like to feel like that.
So acknowledging that it didn't you could never feel the same way, did it change your perspective in your reporting and your commentary?
I think it did, especially the first time I went there. I mean, to know what those jobs are like, what it involves, how much it limits your life, what you can do, not do. I think these are things that are important to know. Mm. You don't have to do it yourself. You can talk to people, interview people. In a sense, it's a bit of a gimmick to do it yourself because you're saying to what are going to be mostly middle-class readers, come with me on a journey. It's a kind of travelogue. Imagine this was you. Imagine you were sitting at this bench, working this lathe. Mm. Imagine you were sitting in this, standing in this Tate & Lyle factory, moving bags of Tate & Lyle sugar. To try to get people to engage in a more imaginative way. Mm. So I think it's quite a useful form of reporting, as long as you don't delude yourself that you know what it feels like to be those people.
Mm. But it's also interesting you sort of had these grand ideas that you could be labourer by day and, you know, George Eliot by night, and you realised you were too bone-tired to be able to do that.
That was at the very beginning, yes. Mm. When I left Oxford halfway through and I went off and got a factory job and thought, and I rewrote one novel, I thought, I'll write my second novel in the evening. It's kind of why not many people who work in factories or work in catering or work in care homes actually produce many books. Mm. And that exhaustion by the end of the day, out of the question.
And I also loved you to tell this little sort of snippet of life on the factory line where you're in the cake-making factory and you sort of start engaging in this sort of, you know, that quiet warfare across the conveyor belt with another woman, and you realise it becomes all-consuming as a worker. These little micro battles of work.
No, if you're in a very mindless job, the very smallest things matter. This one I was writing in the 1970s when strikes were all big news, and everybody was saying, "How dare they be going on strike over tea breaks or over?" And you realise, in those monotonous jobs, every little thing matters. And if somebody takes 5 minutes off your tea break or expects you to work 5 minutes unpaid at the end, when you were counting the clock every minute, if some bit of equipment doesn't quite work or doesn't work very well and you're constantly having to readjust for it, that is infuriating. Or if, when I was working in a care home, there are never enough rubber gloves, wipes, all the equipment that you need basically for looking after people in a care home, never enough. Endless arguments about who's stashing stuff away because these mean companies never give you enough equipment. Mm. Or even in the hospital, there not being enough wheelchairs, so the experienced porters would hide one around the corner because there were never enough. And interestingly, people always have the idea that people in low-paid jobs would all skive off given half a chance. What really frustrated them more than anything was not being able to do their job as well as they thought they could. Mm. And if only managers asked them how they could do it better, how they could organise things better, that annoyed them much more than their own terms and conditions. Mm. And I think people should be listening much more to the workforce and discussing with them ways of working that are more collaborative and more productive. Mm.
Sorry, I've just lost my train of thought for a minute. But I guess you talk about that sort of lack of social mobility and the consequence of those changes that happened under the Thatcher years. Why has that been so difficult to unwind? And as you say, we're not seeing things get better.
Well, that's what's been most depressing. I mean, when I was writing this book, I was thinking, of my ancestors who all fought these good battles against the empire, well, the empire's gone, against capital punishment, first Australians against transportation, and all the way through in favour of women's rights, all the way through, fought all these good causes. And they were mostly won. But I think what shocked them most now is to find that from, say, 1900 all the way down to the end of the 1970s, there was greater and greater equality in terms of both wealth and income. And after that, it took off in the opposite direction. Mm. Partly this process of outsourcing all jobs so that you could hold down the pay of the bottom half of people, and partly taking the lid off at the top, where suddenly astronomical sums being earned by CEOs, mm, in a way that really wouldn't have been acceptable when the unions were strong. But breaking the unions made a big difference in the 1980s and changed the culture in an important way. So I think to find that social mobility, which all politicians say, oh, we're all for social mobility, aspiration, moving up ladders, they never talk about anybody having to move down to make room for anybody else to move up. No, not my children. The social mobility has actually gone backwards. That birth is destiny more certainly now than when I was born, which was end of 1946. Well, that's pretty shocking. Mm. And yet politicians go on in this glib way, well, you know, we're going to have more equal opportunities. But they never realise that equal opportunities are completely impossible in a country as unequal as ours and yours. That equality has to come first. Equality of opportunity comes out of it. If you look at the countries where there is most social mobility, the ladder is shorter and the trajectory and the angle softer in those, say, Nordic countries. So that if you have a much greater level of equality to begin with, then you have much more chance of people moving both up and down the ladder, penalty for falling down the ladder not nearly so great. Mm. Whereas the steeper the ladder, the more the ones at the top will cling to it for themselves and their children.
So why is it so difficult? I mean, obviously, you've been dominated by Tory governments in the UK in recent times, but why is it so difficult to unwind? And are you optimistic at all about a change of government in the UK and how that might try and improve the situation?
Well, you always have to be optimistic. And, you know, we've had 14 years of deep pessimism of terrible things happening and huge cuts to public services, huge increases in inequality, huge cuts to benefits for people in work. They always say hardworking people, but the top-up benefits for them have been cut as well. But of course I'm optimistic because we are at last on the threshold of a Labour government. And, you know, over two-thirds of my life has been under a Tory government. So we look at Anthony Albanese and we look for clues as to how do you do it to win and what do you do once you've won. And he's obviously done some very good things like reorganising a tax system to make it fairer. I'm very glad that Keir Starmer talks about class in a way that Tony Blair would never have dared, never did, never went there. He also talks about equality. Tony Blair would never in any court talk about equality of opportunity. At least he understands how far he dares to go. We don't know. Until you get a government, you know what their intentions are. I know they're thoroughly decent. I know the front bench of an excellent lot of people. What you never know is how brave they are and what they're going to dare to do or not. And they must say very little before the election, and they're quite right to say very little before the election. You have to take an awful lot on trust. Mm. But I'm pretty trusting in them, and I'm pretty optimistic. Will it ever be enough? Of course not. Is the left ever satisfied? Never. But I'm very much against all those people who are going around trying to get their disillusion in first.
You also talk a lot in the book about the sort of perpetual battle on the left and how it's sort of fight and fight and fight, lose and lose and lose, dust yourself off and yeah, keep fighting. Talk to
Absolutely.
Us about that.
Absolutely. And, you know, losing battles in your lifetime, like all of those battles I mentioned about my ancestors, they lost in their lifetime, but they won in the end. And they were examples of mavericks, eccentrics. You know, to be anti-empire, anti-colonial was a very eccentric thing. To be pro-Irish home rule was very eccentric. To be pro suffragette. But nevertheless, they win. And then they suddenly become great national heroes for having won these causes, but always against the forces of conservatism. And so one should learn from that, never to be afraid to be in a small minority, because very often you win. The only one they didn't win was temperance, and I'm quite glad they didn't.
I mean, dismantling the British class system seems quite a challenge ahead, or quite a task ahead. Do you think that, I mean, this book is really interesting because it talks about class in a way that is unusual. Do you think that there is much sort of public consciousness of class, or is it still that kind of unspoken undercurrent that, you know, pervades people's lives, but it's not acknowledged?
I think mostly people understand it pretty well, but a lot of people are going to busy deny it, because people maybe dress more the same than they used to, because maybe the outward signs. But what matters is always follow the money and follow the trajectory of where people go to according to their parents', often education as much as their parents' money. And we're going to go through a phase now of inheritance, where the next generation are going to be even more unequal, because if your parents owned a home and you're going to get an inheritance, such as their parents probably didn't get, the contrast between you and your generation who don't get an inheritance will grow wider and wider. Mm. And yet we have conservatives constantly saying, can't we cut inheritance tax? Mm. Well, we just had a budget yesterday, and they didn't cut inheritance tax, but they did an awful lot of things that generally help the upper half of earners and not the bottom half of earners. Mm. And that is the trajectory. It's what every Conservative budget always does. Mm. And we will now see, I hope, at least a decade of Labour budgets that will try and put it right, and I hope as fast as possible. But it is incredibly difficult. And the thing, I mean, I call myself a social democrat, not a socialist. You know, the point about being a social democrat is that you just constantly want to make things better and fight hard for those battles. But you don't have an end goal that says there will be a golden day when everybody is exactly the same. You avoid that conversation because it's pointless and meaningless, and we're so far from it. There is no point in even thinking about what is the end goal. Let's just think of the next step and then the next step.
And not only are you a social democrat, at one point you put your hand up to be a politician, to be a social democrat politician. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that was a curious stage. It was in the early 80s. When Michael Foot had taken over the Labour Party, and he was for pulling out of Europe and for pulling out of NATO. And it caused a huge split in the Labour Party. We thought the split was going to be bigger. In fact, it was only 36 MPs who split away and set up the Social Democratic Party. I joined them because there was Thatcher on the one side, appalling youth unemployment, and unemployment at that stage soaring upwards, and a Thatcher government that was cutting and cutting again. But the alternative was Michael Foot, and this impossibilist, it was called the longest suicide note in history, was what his manifesto was called. And the idea that you could be for pulling out of Europe and pulling out of NATO was out of the question. So a whole lot of us did join the Social Democratic Party. And we had kind of one chance to shoot through, but as you know, in a first-past-the-post system, it's practically impossible for any new party to get going. And all sorts of people said they would vote for it if they thought we could win, and it's, you know.
But you did quite well.
We did quite well. We came within less than 2 points of behind Labour. And even if we hadn't got that many seats, if we'd got ahead of Labour, I think that might have been the breaking point. But we also knew that one of two things would happen. You know, either we would win, or Labour would eventually, we would help Labour to come to its senses, which we did. And then they had Neil Kinnock next, who was the great sort of Moses figure who took them, Labour Party, almost all the way back to winning, nearly winning, we hoped, in 1992. But not quite, but he brought the Labour Party back to an electable position. And so, you know, I went to work, I jumped out and went to work for the BBC, which meant I could know politics, which was my escape. And then when I left the BBC, I went back to the Labour Party.
And Labour in Australia has been heavily influenced by UK Labour, and particularly, I think we all know, after Blair's New Labour, and, you know, the fact that Labour in Australia is a very neoliberal party. Is the current Labour Party changing? Tell us about that internal dynamic.
It's difficult to know because they are being cautious about what policies they put forward, and I think they're right to do so. And every time, I mean, this one of their policies was to stop nom-doms being able to get this big tax break if you earned your money, for the very super rich, if you could claim you had some spurious connection with abroad. And so Labour was going to get $2 billion out of that, out of abolishing that. Well, the Tories said, this will be outrageous, all the rich will flee. They've just done that themselves today. So they keep stealing Labour policies. So that's another reason why Labour should be quite careful about what it lets out ahead of time. Are they going to be the same? I don't know. I was, you know, the Iraq war was a calamity and a catastrophe that I'd always been against. But domestic policy of Tony Blair was pretty good. A million fewer children in poverty, a million fewer pensioners in poverty. A brilliant programme called Sure Start, 3,500 Sure Start centres for families, early years up to the age of five, to try to get kids and families on their feet by the time they go to infant school, but primary school. And it made a huge difference. The moment the Tories came in, they were all cut. All of Labour's social programmes that had made a lot of difference were cut. And I think we'll see a lot of rebuilding of all of that. And Labour really needs to be in power for a long time to cement those things in. But I am optimistic. And I don't by any means say, you know, there's a tends to be a habit of saying, oh, well, Blairism was all terrible. You know, he did win elections, lots of them.
Now, before we go to audience questions, and we will have some audience questions in a few minutes, so make sure you're mulling those over, and there'll be a microphone in the centre shortly. But I have to ask you about, I mean, it's sort of like the start of a joke, and if I don't ask you about Boris Johnson and family planning, you're going to have a very long queue of people at the end of the of the session. So tell us about naked Boris Johnson, Polly.
I was very young at the time, and I was going up with an extremely nice boyfriend who was about to go off to Oxford. I got pregnant. I was a year younger than him, and I was going to go to Oxford the next year. And I pretty much decided that this was a disaster. I didn't really entertain the idea. His mother was a Catholic and wanted us to get married and wanted us to have a baby, or at least me to have a baby and give it to a Catholic adoption agency, which is the most wicked idea. Anyway, she said to my lover, take her to meet your sister, who is a student at Oxford, and she's looking after her baby at home, and I'm sure she'll see that it's all perfectly doable. So we went to see his sister, and there was her baby lying on a bath mat, very round and pink, pudgy, about 6 months old or so, kicking his legs in the air, making a hell of a noise and a great shock of yellow hair. And that was the naked Boris Johnson, who looked much the same then as he looks now.
And you still find him as repellent as you did back then.
Absolutely, yeah. Thought, not for me.
It's such a wonderful anecdote, and thank you for sharing it with us. Do we have some questions from the audience?
Hi, thanks, Polly, for sharing the ways in which you experience privilege. I share some of those with you, but in one important respect, I do not share the privilege that you have. You have the privilege of being cisgender. I do not. I am transgender. And so my question is, I know you've written about Germaine Greer's comments about a big, fat, smelly vagina being an essential part of being a woman, to return to genitalia, which we've just been talking about. But I'm just wondering what perspective you can give. I'm curious about the British perspective on being trans. There seems to be so much opposition to particularly trans women like myself in Britain. And I'm wondering what perspective you thought you have on that.
I don't think there is great opposition. I mean, there's a certain amount of argument within feminist ranks. But basically, from the point of view of the state and from the point of view of most people, they think that trans rights are important. Of course, as do I. And, you know, marginal arguments about whether certain changing rooms or whether certain toilets should be used by certain people or not seem to me to be pretty insignificant in the big scheme of things. And I am not eager to get into that debate. I'm very eager to defend trans rights, but I'm also a very strong feminist too. And I think the argument has often been trivial compared to, you know, the big things that we've been talking about today. Okay.
Thank you. Hi, Viz, we can't miss you.
Thank you. Great chat. Enjoyable. Look, to Australians, to this Australian anyway, the House of Lords is absurd. Can you defend it to me?
I think you're picking the wrong person there.
No would be the short answer. I mean, it is absurd. It's very difficult to do away with, because what's happened, right since 1911, since Lloyd George first tried, huge numbers of people have tried, said it's absurd, it's embarrassing, it's ludicrous, it's the only theocratic element of any supposedly democratic country. We have 26 bishops, we have 91 hereditaries. Of course it's completely crazy. We have people who buy their place in, increasingly with big donations to the Conservative Party. It's crazy. The problem is always, the moment you get into what do you replace it with, you're into all the arguments. Be careful about the American system, which has become a complete blockage. You do not want to have a second chamber that can block the first chamber. And then you get into the nitty-gritty of how do you replace it. I think probably what Keir Starmer will do, he said he will reform it. He said they won't come till the second term. The first term, I think he'll do away with the, quite quickly do away with the worst atrocities. I mean, you can do away with with the bishops, you can do away with the hereditaries, you can have much stricter rules about people who pay donations don't buy themselves peerages. You can clean it up a lot within its existing structure. But the next stage of it, each time there's been a coalition between traditionalists who don't want to change it at all, and people arguing over which sort of change. So I don't know if we'll get there or not. I hope we do. And I change my mind from time to time as to exactly what kind of structure it should be. I think probably the good idea is not to have elections for it, but to have them being mayors, heads of local governments, people already elected from around the regions collecting together to make a second chamber, rather than having a second directly elected chamber.
Thank you. Makes our wacky Senate not look quite so bad.
No.
Polly, thank you for the inspiration you've been over many decades. I'd like to ask about Toynbee Hall, a community development project of much greater longevity than the commune you talked about. Can you say something about the relationship you have and contemporary Toynbees have with what they do at Toynbee Hall?
Yep. Toynbee Hall is an extraordinary building. It's a sort of pastiche Oxford College, dumped down in what was then one of the poorest parts of the East End, is now not quite so poor. And it was named after my grandfather, Arnold Toynbee. It was named after his uncle, who was confusingly also called Uncle Arnold, who was his uncle, who worked as a social worker in the East End, but was also an academic. He was the one who actually invented the phrase industrial revolution, and he was a quite radical thinker about social history, trade union history, a great promoter of trade unions and cooperatives. But he died very young, his friend said, of a disease caught in the slums of the East End, but I've no idea if that's true or not. And they then set up Toynbee Hall in his name as a great community centre that was an part of what was called the settlement movement, where lots of universities set up offshoots in poor areas and sent their students out to work there to teach, to support, to help people in poor areas. And Toynbee Hall, you know, was very much, it was people passing through the East End of London who were Russians and then Druze and then nowadays very much Bangladeshis, and they do a lot of teaching English to Bangladeshi women. They do a lot of support and help for families there, and it's a great institution. And I go there from time to time and really impressed by their work.
I've just realised I was supposed to read a statement before the question, so just in case, you've all been very well behaved so far, but just in case this next one's a troublemaker, Adelaide Writers Week has a zero tolerance to racism and disrespectful language. If you're asking a question at the microphone, we ask you to keep it civil and remember it's a question. Next question.
Thank you, Polly. I am a troublemaker. I have been called one in many over many years, but not the kind that they're talking about here. And it was wonderful to hear you talking about Toynbee Hall, because when I was working in Britain, I was working on the Toynbee Hall project, so it's a one dear to my heart. I was in Britain for many years, and I came back in here to, in 2019 as what I call a Brexit refugee, so angry about what was happening in Britain that I could hardly contain myself. What I want to ask you is, do you see any hope in Britain renegotiating a supportive mutual partnership with the EU in the foreseeable future? Because I know that Keir Starmer is keeping that very close to his chest as well, understandably.
Yeah. It is really important that Labour does not reignite the Brexit issue before the election, because the one thing the Tories want is to refight a Brexit election. They don't want it to be about the cost of living and the state of the health service and the state of public services, the things that they're in real trouble about. So Labour has been very cautious, saying we work very closely with our European neighbours, and to say nothing more than that. But 2025, as part of the treaty, there is a limited renegotiation coming up, which is a chance to open some things. I don't think that Europe will be in a great hurry to have us back into the single market or the customs union, partly because they won't trust that the Tories won't come in again next time and start the whole Brexit thing over again. I don't think they'd have us back for quite a few years until it was quite plain that the Brexit disease had died out and was no longer this kind of mad fever in the blood of the right wing. And so I'm sure that what will happen next is, for one thing, the importance of NATO, particularly if Trump wins, and the importance of European defence, getting its act together, to work closely together, is going to become very important. So the European entity that is kind of NATO will become much more important. And, you know, if we can make the best trade deals we can, if we can unpick as far as possible things, the madness like musicians not being able to take their instruments across Europe, those sorts of things, I think that Labour will be quite, will find it quite easy to renegotiate. Rejoining Horizon programme, maybe rejoin Erasmus. I think bit by bit, a whole lot of things will happen, but freedom of movement will happen bit by bit, in that we will decide we want a whole lot of Europeans. And actually, people who voted for Brexit are slightly surprised to find we've had even more immigration, but just not from Europe. And I don't know if they felt they wanted a whole lot of people from much further away in the world instead of Europeans. I don't think that necessarily thought that's what they voted for. So it may be that all sorts of visa schemes can operate in a way that makes a flow of people between Britain and Europe easier. I'm optimistic it'll get better, but yeah, like you, every time I think about Brexit, I just nearly despair of our country. But I think we're healing little by little.
Has there been much head scratching since, when obviously, you know, Brexit was put up as this panacea for a lot of people's social ills? Has there been much head scratching? Think, well, actually, that didn't fix it.
Yeah. No, I think there's absolute rage. All the so-called red wall seats that were Labour seats, but Brexit turned them over the other way, and Boris lied to them and lied to them and lied to them again. And they felt that all of their resentments, everything would somehow come right. And nothing has come right. Everything has got worse, and I think they're really quite angry. They're not angry to necessarily to the degree of saying, I think I voted the wrong way. That asks a lot of people. But simply to say, it's been done badly, it's been a disaster, overwhelming numbers of people say it hasn't gone well, is the first stage towards trying to get it out of our system.
Next question.
Hello, Polly. Thank you for your Wildean wit. I have a question about voters in the electorate. I think we voters, both in the United Kingdom and Australia, complain about politicians. But really, what the problem is, in my opinion, is that they are puppets for their corporate masters. Do you see any pathway to uncoupling this?
Well, the big corporate masters are terrifyingly huge. If you know, if you mean the great big sort of Googles and Facebooks and Amazons and people who are, you know, take over so much of our lives, the only hope is for Europe and Britain with Europe to tax them properly, to make sure they pay their taxes in the country where they make their earnings, and to try and get a hold of them. And it's only by operating collectively so that you don't get some countries undercutting others. I mean, Dublin has a tendency to offer very, very low rates of tax in exchange for Apple being able to pretend that they're based there with about two men and a dog, but their tax base is there. So with that kind of cheating, I think we can deal with. But yeah, I think it's even scarier than it's been in the past, the extent to which we are now so dependent. I am totally dependent on that little thing in our pocket, which dominates our lives. But only collective action can hope to keep it in some kind of control.
Mm. That's a topic for another session altogether. Next question, thank you.
Thank you very much, Polly, for coming to see us. We love to see you. I have a question. If Labour does get in, what do you think the relationship will be with the Scottish National Party?
Well, all depends on what the majority is. It all depends. I mean, to get Labour to get in, it needs to win quite a lot of SNP seats. And at the moment, looks as if it will win quite a lot of those Scottish seats. It used once upon a time to be Labour seats, but Labour was very complacent about them and really deserved to lose them and get a shock in it because it was quite a corrupt party in Scotland. So what will their relationship be? Well, it depends. Will they need SNP votes to get things through or not? Will the SNP demand a referendum in exchange? I don't think Labour could give them that, and I don't think they would. But, I mean, certainly on a lot of broad social policies, they will surely agree. But it may be that the SNP will constantly have to find reasons why it disagrees over some small reason why it won't vote for things that are progressive that Labour's putting forward. We can only wait and see. At the moment, it looks as if Labour's going to get a stonking great majority. But we don't know. I mean, I don't want the Scots to go. I really, really don't want the Scots to go. If I was Scottish, it might be different.
Next question, thank you.
Again, thank you for coming, Polly. My question's about education, privilege and left-wingers. Is there any pressure in the UK to begin, if any way, or increase public funding of private schools, as there is in Australia, of course? Is that so? And do you have swathes of left-wingers who send their kids to private schools or who subsidise their grandchildren going to private schools?
Much less than before, in that you couldn't... I don't think any Labour front page or any Labour MP these days would ever send their child to private school. It'd be out of the question. Whereas in the old days, Sir Harold Wilson's front bench, a lot of them would have sent their children to private schools. So that's been quite a shift. And one of the most controversial things that Labour is committed to doing is to charge VAT on private school fees. That's an extra 20% that will go on to private school fees. And, of course... this has been called, attacked by the Telegraph and the Mail and the Murdoch press as politics of envy and all of that. And all those poor parents will have to take their children away from private schools now, which is complete rubbish because private school fees have been soaring up anyway. People have quite happily gone on paying it. So, I mean, it's a small step. And then there's an argument about whether they will also remove their charitable status, which they might at some point. But certainly 20% as from day one, and it brings in quite a lot of money that is all committed to be spending on state schools, which are deeply underfunded, have been cut. They are at the moment 9% less funded than they were in 2010. And, you know, desperate shortage of teachers, teaching assistant of equipment, 40% fewer children now doing any arts subjects at GCSE. So art, music, drama, dance, you know, orchestras, all of these things have been cut right away because the Tories decided that it was only, you know, the hard subjects that matter. And once a school wasn't judged on its arts and once a school was stripped of money, it lost its arts teaching, and it's been absolutely tragic for a generation. I mean, a generation of people who would contribute to the arts and who would be audiences for the arts. And Labour has said they are going to bring back school enrichment, and I hope they use a lot of that private school money for that.
We have time for just one more quick question, so Over to you.
Thank you, Polly. Have you been surprised by anything after writing this book about how you feel?
About how I feel? Well, I think it's been very good for me, really, because I've had to confront with absolute honesty what it is to be privileged. And to write that book, you had to strip away everything. You had to really, really fess up in a way that would be very uncomfortable. But then I find once I'd done that, it was fine. And what's more, a whole lot of other people reading the book say, yeah, being honest about privilege is a very good thing, not to shy away, not to pretend, not to try and find some reason why you're not so privileged. Being honest about it feels quite a relief, I think, not being shy and embarrassed, being able to say, yep, I'm really privileged. I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I have no idea whether I deserve this lucky position I'm in. Pontificating to all you here today, I had no idea. My family have done that for generations, and now here I am doing it too.
Well, we are very, very lucky. We all count ourselves as extremely privileged to listen to you speak today. We ask everyone to please support our authors, and you will not regret buying Polly's fantastic book. It is an absolutely rollicking read. Polly Toynbee, thank you so much. Dare I say, you've been a class act for us all today.
Thank you very much, too.